It's like we're an asshole magnet.
Michelle.
Jordy. Hello. Very nice to see ya. See ya nice. Oh, isn't that a thing?
That's a thing. That's a Brucey thing. People outside of the UK won't know that. Bruce Forsyth.
Or Forsyth. If you're not a Toast fan.
Forsyth.
For anyone who doesn't even know what we are talking about. Bruce. Bruce Forsyth.
Bruce Forsyth.
He's Forsyth.
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 Oh my God, stop.
Host of...
Was host of Strictly...
Hang on, is he dead?
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
Strictly and The Generation Game were the things that he used to be on. And many other things. You know, they're all popping their clogs these days, aren't they, Michelle? All the famous people that we grew up with, possibly.
Yeah.
Although I noticed Ita Buttrose is still going.
Is she Ita?
Yes. Ita, didn't you talk about her recently? Wasn't she the head of something? The head of the ABC, you told
what?
Me.
What? No, I didn't tell you that. Me. No, some other Australian.
Somebody else told me. Yes, it was a young person who didn't know her affiliation with the Australian Women's Weekly. Those of you not from Australia won't know who we're talking about. Why don't we just start again and introduce ourselves? Because you guys know us, right? I'm Geordie.
And I'm Michelle. And you are... listening to Eavesdropping, which makes you an eavesdropper.
And I bet you wish you weren't.
After right that now. Preamble.
Apologies, apologies. What's the latest with Michelle?
Went for a ski.
Wow. That's so posh and fancy, isn't it?
No, it's not. But it was a beautiful day. It's sunshine, blue skies. Unbelievable. It feels like summer has arrived.
Oh, that's nice. So how was the snow if it was summer?
Amazing.
Right. A little bit confusing, but never mind.
They call them a bluebird day when there's blue sky and sunshine. Very, very nice.
Nice. Well, I've been doing no such fancy, expensive sports pursuits.
You did a dog walk.
I walked a dog. Not quite the same. Yeah.
It is. Same, same.
Not
same
really. Deal.
That's about it, really. That's all I do.
Okay. That's all I do is ski, ski, ski. Well, you sound really fancy, Michelle. Let's go there.
Not at all.
I've been thinking about restaurants and eating out, actually, because a friend of ours, a friend of the show, Janneke from Amsterdam, asked for a recommendation for restaurants in London.
Okay.
And I'm quite lucky. Yes, I live in London, number one. Number two, I have a friend who I often go out for dinner with, not my husband. We like to save the money and stay at home and bicker. That's what we do. We're married. But with my friend Julius, we go out probably once a month because he currently lives in the same city as me, won't for much longer. And we go to some really nice restaurants, Michelle.
Great.
Yeah. So I was able to tell her a few recommendations and somebody in my work also gave me a few recommendations as well. So it just made me think how lovely it is to be able to do that, to go out to restaurants and enjoy nice food and atmosphere. It's fun.
It is, considering during COVID, nobody could do that. I will say, though, you think that going out to a restaurant is very nice. When you're on the other side of that, I can't tell you the amount of assholes we've had in the restaurant lately.
Really?
It's like we're an asshole magnet currently. I don't know why. I mean, how hard is it for somebody to come, sit down and enjoy a nice meal? How hard?
I don't know. Tell me, what sort of trouble have you been getting? I am intrigued.
A lot of dickheads who...
Are they wanting burgers?
Oh, we have that. We get the clicking fingers. We have the, I just want a steak.
Oh, God.
Steak and chips.
Who puts their fingers up and clicks at you, Michelle? I'd really love to see that.
Doesn't go down well. Let me tell you.
I would love to be a fly on the wall for that.
I will say, you know, we're an international village here. We get guests from all around the world. And I don't want to culture shame here, so I won't.
Well, you're going to.
No, though. I'm not. I will just say there are two cultures that do the clicking fingers and think that it's acceptable. But I'm here to tell you it's not fucking acceptable. You don't do that in a restaurant ever.
French and Americans, please stop.
Well, actually, okay, four. There are another two.
Who are the other two?
I don't want to say. I feel bad.
Well, I've just said two.
Let's just say the accent is a little bit like this. Oh, that's a terrible accent. You wouldn't even know
what was that? Scottish.
What? I was trying to be Russian.
Let's move on before we shame any more countries, because if you're from any of those countries just mentioned,
sorry,
you're not included in that group of
because you're eavesdroppers and we love you.
Exactly. Unless you are clicking your fingers right now at the poor lady behind the desk at McDonald's. Another place where Michelle works.
Has worked. I had a wonderful start in life to my hospitality career at Mac.
Did anybody ever click a finger at McDonald's?
No, but
I want that bloody burger and I want it stat.
Give me that quarter pounder. No, I mean, we did get some assholes through the drive-through, and I'll tell you what.
People on dares
drunk. People driving drunk in the drive-through.
It's dreadful because the staff are like 16. It's not fair.
I know, it's not fair. And also too, for anyone who's not from Australia, another drive-through that we have in Australia is bottle shops. You have a drive-through bottle-o, we call them.
I forgot about that.
So I think they go to the bottle-o and then
They've driven through
and then they're picking up their Maccas. And I'll tell you now, if you messed with me when I was on drive through, when you got your bag, your paper bag.
What else did you get?
Everything might have been a bit squashed inside. I crumpled that bag. I wasn't a great employee at Maccas, I will tell you that much for free.
Oh, so what do you do to the people who click their fingers at you, Michelle? Do you just stand there and stare them down?
That's one tactic, yes. Certainly when that happens, you have to lose the friendliness and you just get steely.
Do you ever say anything like, if you want my attention, this room is quite small, just put your hand up or just get my attention with eye contact? I don't like to respond to clicks.
It's not really that kind of conversation, especially when there's language and cultural barriers as well. Mm-hmm. Yes, you just have to table by table, guest by guest, figure it out.
Have you had any shouting matches?
Oh, I yelled today, actually.
You can't do that, Michelle. You're the service provider.
I didn't yell in the restaurant. I yelled in the lift, the ski lift today.
Oh.
It was actually an elevator lift. It was like being on the Japanese subway or the London tube in rush hour.
Okay.
Everyone was cramming in like sardines. And, you know, I'm small, so I just had a little space. And yes, I had my face in someone's armpit and
bumhole, I suppose, because you are only little. That happened to me as well. Listen, I've done that twice this week. I don't know what's going on, but it's just getting more and more crowded in London on the transport.
Yeah, well, this was insane today. I got pushed because I was already squishing, you know, you take it. But then a guy came in with a massive backpack and his skis and pushed into me, and I just went, stop! And I screamed. And I said, there's no space for you. And then he turned around. So his backpack was then facing towards the doors of the lift.
Yeah.
Well, those lift doors wouldn't close. Oh. And I was like, you need to get out. Because I'm little, but I'm quite vocal.
Oh, I know.
Yes, you do.
I've seen you. Seen you in action.
Of course. So he got out. I think I shamed him out of the lift. And
good.
The doors went to close. Well, what dickhead on the outside of the lift trying to get in presses the button? So then the doors open. This went on for minutes.
Oh. Were you the only one screaming and shouting?
I was the loudest. For sure. I was like, stop pressing the button. Honestly, I am a nightmare. But
wow,
we got that lift closed and up. Only good. For me to find at the very top about 3,000 people all trying to get on to the ski lift.
Oh, yikes.
That's how it goes. But once you're up, once you're on that lovely slope.
Bit of snow. Do you just go down once and that's it? We're done for the day.
No, I actually pushed myself to do a good day for me. So I was skiing on my own. Very nice. But a lot of helicopters, a lot of injuries today.
Oof. Why so busy?
Half term for somewhere in Europe. Someone's half term. So a lot of rescues today.
Mm-mm.
Avalanches too.
Avalanches.
Yep. Scary stuff, people.
That's not a sport for me when there's, you know, life and limb at stake. I prefer paddleboarding on the Thames.
If you go swimming in Australia, Yes. I mean, anything can get you there.
That's true. Usually a blue bottle. You're not really swimming out where the sharks are usually, unless it's dusk or dawn when they're feeding.
That's true. But there's also those itchy lice that are really annoying.
Sea lice.
Oh, God, they're terrible.
Sea lice!
Yes. I mean, look, every sport has its ups and downs.
Yeah.
And so does life, Geordie. So does life. Does it? It does indeed. And I have a story for you.
You're going to be telling the story all on your own today, aren't you, Michelle? This is a deep dive.
It is a deep dive. And this is actually a request from eavesdropper Shari.
You eavesdroppers out there, you are busy, busy bees. We love that you keep writing in. We love that you keep recommending.
We do.
Because I've got something for next week that was recommended by a listener as well.
We love it. If you ask, we generally deliver.
We give.
We give.
We give, you get. We're given, you're getting.
So eavesdropper Shari, she's getting. She was given.
Wow.
Back to the story. She wrote in to see if we could look into this case. Yes, it's a case we're looking at.
It's a true crime. True crime time?
It's true crime time, Geordie.
Murder, murder.
It's true and it's crime.
Crime time.
Murder, murder.
Murder.
Crime time.
Now, Shari's Australian and she wanted us to look into this because it's something that she remembered from back in the late 80s. But when she was chatting to her friend Yasmin about it, Yasmin had never heard of it. So today we're going back in time to December 18th, 1989. My favorite decade. 89. Still in the 80s.
Is it your favorite year?
No, but it's my favorite decade.
What was happening for you in 89?
Well, do you know what? I was going to say, I'm going to divert from this sad case for a minute because I looked this up because I wanted to see what was going on musically in the Australian top 50 ARIA singles chart at the time.
Yeah, yeah. What happened?
So on 17th of December 1989... Love Shack by B-52s, number 3 on the charts.
Love Shack. Yeah.
That's where it's at. Favorite of ours. We have played that live as the
Bush Family Band for all the 40ths way back then. I don't know if I was even in the country then. I think I had already left.
17th of December, India. You were not there, I don't think. We've discussed. You were gone. 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 Now, number 2 on the Australian Top 50 ARIA Singles Chart.
Yes.
We didn't start the fire.
They've changed the words to that. We spoke about that recently, didn't we? Like, yeah, I'm sure we did.
No.
That they've changed the words to it.
Billy Joel.
To update it. I think it was a Billy Joel version or somebody else has decided to do another version. Come on, guys, write in. Tell me what I'm bloody talking about here. Yeah, they've changed the words to be more culturally up to date.
Really?
Or newsworthy. Well,
why? What did they say?
Well, because the old words were talking about things that were going on in 1989, I suspect.
Oh, okay. So they've done a...
I don't know the words. I haven't got them in front of me. Do you want me to pull them up and sing along? That's all I can remember.
That's all we need.
Just the sounds, not the words.
Okay, well, I'll have to look into that and link the shit out of that on the Patreon. If you're not a Patreon member, get on it.
Why not? If not, why not?
That was number 2. You're not. I'm going to say have a guess at what was number 1, but you're not going to guess. All I can say is it's annoying as shit, but it's now considered a classic, I guess.
Oh. Okay, I'm supposed to guess. An annoying song? I'm going to have a good time tonight. Rock and roll music's going to play all night. Is it that one?
No, even worse. It's this one. If I could turn back time. Number 1 in the charts. Sure, turn back time.
Wow. Dreadling the gun.
That's a little cultural reference for
If I can turn back. I do remember all those songs coming out because her son was playing guitar.
Really?
In the video.
Really? Yes. I didn't know that. Good bit of trivia there. Thank you very much. Yep.
Thank you.
So this was all on December 17th, 1989. But back to our mystery because
all right.
One day later, on December 18, 1989, in the Southern Highlands in New South Wales, Australia.
That's somewhere like Bowral or Mossman, am I right?
How about Pheasant's Nest?
I don't know that place.
You do.
Do I?
Oh, yes. Every single person driving from Canberra to Sydney goes through Pheasant's Nest because the only thing of note in Pheasant's Nest is a servo. And if you don't know what a servo is, because you're not Australian, it's a service station. That's it.
Okay.
And there's always that big sign.
I don't recall any of this.
Really? It's the place where you go when you need a paddle pop or
not for me.
To go to the toilet. Yes, everyone's been through Pheasant's
Nest.
Well,
no, because I didn't grow up in Canberra. I was either going from the coast to Canberra or the coast to Sydney.
So you've never done from Canberra to Sydney?
With you, I did, when it hailed.
No, we were coming up from the coast.
Well, there you go.
We didn't do it that time.
Yeah.
Well, maybe you don't. Okay, well.
Pheasant's Nest.
Pheasant's Nest.
Right, no, I don't know.
Pheasant's Nest, it is basically the middle of nowhere.
With a service station.
Population, less than 1,000 people. Inland from Wollongong, highway town. The only reason anyone even knows the name of this place is because you see that sign. You know that you've got an hour to go till you hit the outskirts of Sydney, and you know you're better stop there because it's your last chance for like 100 Ks to fill up if you're going from Sydney to Canberra.
I did do a bus last time and there was a ravine.
A ravine.
A ravine. I remember going over a ravine and it was quite shockingly high and scary because it was pissing with rain.
Okay. Was it a massive bridge?
Yeah.
A huge bridge. Geordie.
I'd never done it before.
This is exactly what I'm talking to you about today. We are talking about the boys in the bridge.
What? That bridge, it was so scary. There's nothing else there, but it's really stunningly beautiful. And I remember looking out the window thinking, I was a little bit scared actually, because it was raining so hard. The bus had to pull over for a little bit.
Yep. That is the bridge that takes you over the Nepean River.
Oh, right. The Nepean. Okay.
Yes. And if you're driving, you still have to go over that bridge. But Pheasant's Nest is the place where you stop if you need to do a wee or want a bag of minties or whatever.
So that's an interesting combo. So what's the boys in the bridge, Michelle? It sounds frightening.
Well, like I said, December 18, 1989, 14-year-old friends, Matthew Kelly and Jamie Egner, they just started their school summer holidays. For listeners not in Australia, we don't have a white Christmas in Australia. It's Santa on the beach, chugging beers in thongs. That's what we've got. That's the main school holidays. It's summer holidays. You get the first week of December and then at school, and then you've got the last 3 weeks and a few into January, give or take. So these kids were just starting their school holidays.
Yeah.
And like I said, they lived in Pheasant's Nest, middle of nowhere, no man's land, in the scrub of the upper Nepean bush. As a kid, like anywhere in any small town anywhere in the world, there's not much to do. And particularly around there, you have to make your own fun, right? On this day, in the middle of a really hot summer, Matthew and Jamie told their parents they were going to go for a dip at the local swimming hole. And it was called locally the Pothole. It's along the Nepean River. And I've seen pictures of where they were going to go.
Yeah.
And it's gorgeous. It's all red and sand colored rock falling into this beautiful blue swimming hole. And apparently it was a really popular place to swim.
That sounds beautiful. It sounds like when we went to France that one time, do you remember? And we found somewhere like that with just rocks and deep ravines, pools and...
It's like that, but imagine an Australian spin on that.
Okay.
So just really rugged, a lot of scrub, you know, no tall trees, but more this scrubby bushland with this gorgeous kind of crack in the earth, and that's what this swimming hole is.
Oh, post pics.
Yeah, I will. I'll pop them on the Patreon. It was a really popular place. They'd been there loads, so there was no issue with them going on their own. Plus, this was the 80s when parents were like, you kids just scram.
We'll see you when it gets dark.
Exactly. So we all grew up like this. So for anyone who's kind of putting a lens of today's parenting on parenting in the 80s.
Yeah.
These parents were not at fault. Everyone did it. Everyone let their kids go all day. There were no phones. You couldn't keep in touch. You just trusted your kids would go out and come back. And also, this is in the middle of nowhere. The biggest danger was probably drowning, I would say.
Well, that's a big deal.
It is a big deal. But they were 14 and 15. You know, they're not small kids.
Australian children get really comprehensive swimming lessons as well, don't they, from a young age, part of the curriculum.
Exactly. So after having lunch at Jamie's mum's house in Pheasant's Nest, they set off to walk the 2 kilometres to the pothole. And like I said, 2 Ks to walk there, 2 Ks to walk back, plus hanging out time at the pothole. In terms of the parents thinking about the timing, it was not going to be weird that the kids weren't home for hours, right? But when it started to get dark and the kids weren't home, the parents started to get worried and they called the police. And within a short period of time, authorities, locals, friends, everyone from Pheasant's Nest, they all were out looking for these kids. And they went down to the river, they went to the pothole, they were searching the bushland and all the surrounds. Oh, but after hours of searching, Geordie, nothing.
Oh, that's so sad. Not a trace. Oh my God.
So it was not looking good for the boys. And the media was alerted to the fact that 2 teenage boys had gone missing. And they were calling for any witnesses who might have seen them or anyone who had some leads as to where the boys might be.
Well, I imagine it would have been very busy that day, being the school holidays, being the local swimming hole, hot day. There'll be a ton of witnesses who would have seen them.
Well, look, 2 witnesses did come forward in the following days to say they had seen who they thought might have been the 2 boys on the highway between Bargo and Tarmoor. Now, again, these are little tiny no man's land towns, but they're in the opposite direction
of home
to the pothole.
Oh.
These witnesses said they saw them on the highway at 2 p.m. on that Monday. Like I said, opposite direction to the pothole, which does beg the question, were the witnesses wrong? Mm-hmm. Were the kids they saw on the road Matthew and Jamie? Yeah. Or did the boys lie to their parents and tell them that they were going to the pothole, but really they went somewhere else?
Okay.
Well, one of Matthew and Jamie's mates was a kid called Philip Hendricks. And at the beginning of the investigation, he came forward to the police with loads of information, including that he was meant to have met up with Matthew and Jamie that day to go swimming with them at the pothole, but decided to stay home instead. And the kids, Matthew and Jamie, had also talked about walking further down the river, which they'd planned on doing, but of course, they didn't tell their parents they were going to do this, because the parents would have said, no, you're not allowed to do that. So he told police he thought that's maybe why they were spotted on the highway rather than near the pothole. Now, when that bit of info was told to the police, they started coming up with other theories, one of which was that maybe the boys had decided to run away from home.
In just like swimming shorts and a towel.
Well, this is it. They put it to Matthew and Jamie's parents, like, could these kids be runaways? But both families were like, absolutely not. You know, there were no problems at home. There was nothing that they could think of that would motivate their kids to run away, especially as it was school holidays. It was near Christmas. The boys were excited for, you know, long days doing nothing in the sunshine, Santa's coming, presents, you know, all of that stuff. So it's not a typical time to run away. And also, like you pointed out, both parents said the boys didn't take any money or clothes with them. And after checking through bits of stuff in their homes, they confirmed to police also that no camping equipment was missing. Right. So running away was ruled out by the police pretty early on in the investigation. In fact, in a Sydney Morning Herald article that, full disclosure,
you didn't read. Okay, so how do you know these things? Are you skimming them?
No, do you know what? It's behind a paywall.
Oh.
I was like, oh, okay, we need a bit more money in the Patreon fund before I can get over the paywall. I did find this quote online from the friend, Philip Hendricks, that is supposedly, and I can't vouch for it, but supposedly from the Sydney Morning Herald article that says, The worst thing is that I'm pretty sure they have not run away because they would tell me for sure.
Oh, they were that close, the three of them.
Yeah.
Little buds.
Which is adorable and heartbreaking at the same time because, you know, kids at that age, they're teenage boys who do stuff together. Yeah. They tell each other when things are shit or if they're running away from home.
Mm.
And he said, they didn't tell me, so it can't be true.
Yeah.
But on the flip side of that, actually, if you believe that they didn't run away, then you also have to think, you know, the chances of them being found alive are getting slimmer and slimmer. Yeah. So by December 27, 10 days later, actually 9 days later, police had received loads of reports of sightings of the boys from the public. And people were ringing in saying they'd seen them up and down New South Wales, you know, hundreds of kilometres away, even as far as Port Stephens, which is north of Newcastle.
Right.
None of these sightings added up. And the police decided to search the area around Pheasant's Nest and the pothole again, even though they knew that it was more than likely that the boys probably never went to the pothole that day. Then, 3rd of January 1990... a government roads inspector went to Pheasant's Nest Bridge, the one we just talked about that scared the shit out of you. He was there to do a routine check of the bridge. Now,
it's high, isn't it? It's like one of those great big, it's almost like one that you would see in England with a canal.
It's fucking massive. On it.
Like the, what do they call them? Viaducts, like the old Roman bridges. But you don't have an old Roman bridge in Australia because obviously it wasn't around in Roman times,
no.
The European civilization.
It's huge. I don't know how many kilometres it is, but it's a really, really long bridge. It's high. It's part of the Hume Highway and it takes you over the Nepean River. It was built in 1980, so relatively at that time, new bridge.
Wow, that's a new bridge, yeah.
It's a concrete bridge and it's what they call a box girder construction, meaning that it has, the bridge has a hollow interior under the actual road.
Oh.
Yeah. And it was designed like this so it could be accessed. All parts of the bridge could be accessed by the hollow pieces, like under the actual road surface.
You're reminding me so much of the fear that I felt going across that bridge. I'd never been on it before, but I was really frightened.
I've never even thought of it. I'm always like, oh, it's a bridge, whatever. But if you look down, you're like, fuck, we're high.
Yeah, I looked down.
Yeah, don't look down. The way that you access the hollows is through one of four hollow pylons that are covered over with really heavy manhole covers.
But how'd you get there? Do you have to like shimmy off the side of the bridge?
No, there is a structural access ramp under the road service. And that's how people like the roads inspector get underneath. So, you know, like they've really thought it through. He went down through this access ramp on January 3 and he was like, fuck me, what is that really foul stink?
Oh no.
And it's so off that he calls it in. He calls the Wee-Wa police.
Who are they?
Yeah, there's a place called Wee-Wa.
Oh, I see, it's a place, right.
It is the Wee-Wa police.
I thought it was an acronym or
no.
A short for something.
The Wee-Wa.
Yeah.
Michelle. Sorry. It's an actual place. But okay. I mean, I'm sure their police department consists of, you know, a bloke and his dog.
Yeah.
They went to the area and after not too much searching, they did discover the bodies of Matthew Kelly and Jamie Egner.
Oh, God, that's devastating. Oh, that's really upset me. I had a feeling, obviously, that this wasn't going to turn out okay, but that's just really heartbreaking.
It's awful. And they were found at the bottom of the southeasternmost pylon of the bridge. And like I said earlier, the pylons are hollow and the boys' bodies were lying at the bottom of the pylon. It's just awful.
In it?
Yes. They've fallen into the hollow pylon.
Oh, God. Accidentally.
Well, keep listening, my friend.
Oh, dear.
Reporting at the time speculated that the boys had been walking along the service walkway, which apparently runs the whole length of the bridge. And the way they'd gotten in the first place was through a vandalized entrance at the bottom of a ramp into the bridge's interior. And somehow, God knows how, the pair of them had fallen into one of the access points to one of these four hollow pylon supports. And Geordie, it's not a quick fall. It's 33 meters.
Oh my God.
And honestly, if you fall in, you are not getting out.
You can't get out. Oh dear.
You're in. And if you're falling 33 meters,
this is so nightmarish.
It is. So look, one of the early thoughts in the investigation was that maybe the boys lost their balance as they were trying to lift the manhole cover off to see what was underneath, mm-hmm. and kind of pulled into the pylon shaft after the cover fell in. But the cover wasn't in there, and it's never been found.
So the cover was off and gone.
Cover was off and gone. And the thing is, this cover, it's
big and heavy.
Apparently, the roads inspector said you would need four massively strong men to even try and lift one of those covers off.
That's
and you've got two 14-year-old boys here.
Oh dear.
The cover falling in theory, no, it's not going to happen because it was already gone and the cover's never been found. So too heavy for the boys to move. That was pretty quickly ruled out. Although Philip Hendricks, the boy's friend, told the police that playing near the pylons was pretty normal stuff for the local kids. And he said loads of other kids had explored that bridge and other bridges in the area before. And it's one of those things that all the kids know that you're not allowed to do, which means you do it anyway because they're bored teenagers in a tiny town in the middle of freaking nowhere in the Southern Highlands. When there's nothing else to do, I can see why you would think hanging out in a concrete bridge is fun. So when the police investigated a little deeper, they realized that the walkway to the bridge had been entered illegally in the past, mm-hmm. meaning the boys were not the first to be in the interior of that bridge. And like I said, they also never found the manhole cover, just missing.
Yeah.
They could have been missing for months, which means this big gaping hole, which is a total like health and safety risk, could have been like that for months. Nobody knows. And that 33-meter drop was open and dangerous for anyone to fall into.
Yeah.
So maybe what happened to the boys really was an accident because mm-hmm. obviously there's only one entry point down that manhole and that's from the top. And there's no other way they could have ended up at the bottom of that pylon except from the top.
Both of them.
Yeah.
Both of them going in is just that thing that makes me think, hang on, one's gone in. It's a long drop. The other one's not going to go in after him to try and help him. He's going to go get help.
Well, that's the thing. I think that's what's so curious about this case and why people are saying, what the fuck is going on here? Is because two boys, one huge shaft. Like, why? How? So on the 5th of January, Geordie, police made a statement and they said, quote, "We don't know whether it had a cover or not at the time the boys fell down the shaft." The police were openly admitting they don't know. And that's a big deal because that implies that some government people maybe were not doing their job properly because you should not let an entrance to a 33-meter drop shaft where there's one way in, no way out. Yeah, you shouldn't be letting that happen.
How did they find the boys down there? How did they get to the bottom? Was there another access point?
What do you mean? How did they get...
They fell down from the top.
Yes.
How do you get into the bottom?
You don't.
How did they get them out?
So I actually did a lot of digging into this and there was some anecdotal comments on Reddit. One from this woman saying, my brother was the guy who had to abseil down and along with another guy to pull these
inside.
Boys out. Yep. She said her brother was traumatized for decades.
I'm sure.
A, the boys in a hot summer had decomposed and were it was really bad. B, the shaft is, it's not narrow, but there's a lot of things sticking out.
Yeah.
So bits of metal and whatever, and it was really dangerous to get down there, really dangerous to get those kids out, and those kids were not in good shape. Yeah, they had to do a rescue, like a body recovery rescue operation, and it wasn't good.
Oh dear.
So that's, like I said before, one way in, no way out on your own steam. Now, the police also said they couldn't confirm whether any of the other pylons had the covers on.
They couldn't confirm? How could they not confirm that?
I know, mate, just go and fucking look.
Couldn't or wouldn't?
Well, I don't know. But it's like, surely you just need one person to go, yep, that one's on, that one's on, and then you know.
Well, they're not confirming that for a reason, Michelle.
And I don't know why.
It's not because they haven't checked it.
Exactly. Health and Safety 101, check those fucking covers. And if you're covering it up, the fact that you're not going to say whether or not you're going to confirm them, there's something
Something's going on. Yep.
But it didn't take too long for the police to look at what happened to the boys from two different angles. Accident or foul play?
Okay. Were they able to do a post-mortem examination on the children?
Yes. And I believe that there was nothing found that indicated foul play.
They died from injuries from falling.
Yes. Look, apparently a lot of the police team working the case felt that there were massive question marks around what happened to Matthew and Jamie, i.e. did they fall or were they pushed?
Right.
And the coroner's inquiry was conducted by a forensic examiner called Esther McKay. And she looked into the case and eventually did conclude that what happened to the boys was an accident or misadventure.
Were they alive when they went in as well?
That was another question that was asked. The boys' bodies were in a pretty bad state, but certainly if Australia had had a body farm at that point, maybe right, there would be some information. You know, when something like this happens to two smart, curious teenage boys in the scrubland, the mind is going to jump to all sorts of conclusions. Did they fall? Were they pushed? Were they thrown in? And if foul play is a factor, the next question is, who wants to kill two teenage boys? Like I mentioned before, this part of New South Wales is right in the heart of the Nepean bushland, where there is no one around. Literally no one. And no one goes into the scrub because there's nothing there. You know, the pheasant's nest servo is the hottest thing going. With all of this isolation and no one ever having any reason to go into that bushland, it's the perfect place for, I think, burying a body.
Ivan Milat.
That was one of my theories, actually. Totally Ivan Milat country.
Yeah.
And it's the right time. It's not his MO, though. Backpackers. These are just kids, but maybe he was just having a practice run. I don't know.
Yuck.
It is a theory. Another theory is, with all of this isolation, perfect place to set up an illegal weed farm.
Okay. Crims.
Yes. And at the time, there were rumours flying around that maybe the boys saw something they shouldn't have. Look, I will say here that when I first read about this theory that the boys had somehow mistakenly stumbled upon someone's marijuana farm or, you know, their stash, for anyone who's thinking, oh, you know, weed dealers are just hippy-dippy types. Oh, they'd never murder a couple of teenage boys.
No, it's bikers and mafia.
Exactly. And if these kids had seen something like some secret location of a weed farm or where they're drying out their crops or maybe they were drying out their crops in a nice dry bridge interior. Well, we did cover on this very podcast the death of Donald McKay.
Donald McKay.
And the speculation that the Griffith Mafia in Australia, who was controlling all the growing and selling of weed in that area at this time, the Mafia was behind his disappearance and murder because he was trying to shut them down. So I don't think we can rule out that if the boys did see something or discovered something relating to a weed farm, maybe they paid with their lives for what they saw.
Possibly. That amount of money that it would be worth, the risk of losing that, people will do anything, unfortunately.
They do not want two 14-year-olds rocking the boat.
No.
And I did read that when the police were searching the area for the boys, they did actually find an illegal weed farm.
Oh, shit.
And, of course, that discovery sent all the conspiracy theories into overdrive. But the police apparently didn't find anything that connected the boys' death to this big motherfucking package of weed that was also found in the tunnel.
No.
Yes.
With them.
Yes. So in the area where the boys' bodies were, they found this big fucking package of weed.
Huh.
Coincidence? Police corruption? Because we know also from other episodes on this podcast, it was rife in Australia at that time, all the police corruption. So there was one rumour at the time that when the boys were mucking around in the tunnel, they did come across marijuana growers drying out the marijuana inside the bridge. The people, like the growers, panicked that they were busted and that maybe they were dropped down that hole to shut them up.
Yeah.
I mean, plausible? What do you think?
Yeah, I do, actually. I think that's very plausible. And dropping them down a hole would be so much easier because you can just push them down and then not think about it.
Yep. And you don't even have to...
get your hands dirty.
Nope. Look, like I said before, packages of weed were found by police near the boys' bodies.
That's incredible.
And what? They were all packaged up in a way that indicated to police that these blocks shipped. Were, yep, ready for delivery. You know, is finding that weed inside the bridge all ready to roll, to be sold, again, coincidence or cover-up?
No, I just don't know.
I don't know.
I hope you're going to have some answers.
Maybe. The district deputy mayor at the time was also unsure about coincidence or cover-up. So he requested the attorney general seek an inquiry into the whole thing because he believed that it could have been something more sinister and that the boys may have stumbled across some drug-related activity. And he wasn't comfortable just writing off their deaths as an accident. He couldn't get his head around the fact that there were two of them down that hole, that they both just fell down the manhole at the same time.
Yes, they didn't fall.
And one of the reasons this request was taken seriously was because there was speculation that this situation could have been connected to another case on the bridge 2 years earlier.
What?
So two mates, Erin Murphy, 17, and Glenn Vantaggiato, 19, were run over by a newspaper truck on the Old Hume Highway near Tarmoor after lying down on the highway at night.
Oh no, why were they doing that?
Yeah, exactly. Neither of the boys were drunk, and speculation at the time, and even today, has always been focused on, were they alive before the truck hit them, or were they already dead and placed on the road to cover up their murder?
Yeah.
I'm just going to say here, I think if you're run over by a huge lorry, newspaper, truck, there's not much left of the body to be able to know whether you were alive or dead when you're on that road. Again, there's been talk, was it a cover-up? Was it kids just doing dumb shit in the middle of the night? Or...
that doesn't make sense.
No. Maybe those two lads stumbled across a weed farm or drying spot and met their death because of it. No one knows, but... same area, same weird deaths.
That's too similar, I'm afraid.
I feel the same.
Linked, yeah.
And look, after extensive investigation, police eventually rejected the weed theories because the autopsies, as you asked earlier, for Matthew and Jamie did not indicate foul play as far as they could tell. It looked like they just died from falling down that hole. So... the police dismissed the whole marijuana thing in the end.
Somebody can throw them down that hole. They could be forcibly thrown down there by two massive men or four massive men.
Exactly. And look, Geordie, the same as you and me, for many people, the nagging thought that, you know, bags of pot discovered right near their bodies, a whole weed farm that no one knew about discovered in the search for them. A lot of people thought that was more than just coincidence. Now, another idea that was floating around was that, was there a third person with the boys that day? Mm-hmm. So, you know how Philip Hendricks, the boy's friend, told the police that, they were going down the pothole. Eventually, he came clean and said they were never going to the pothole that day.
Right. Okay.
Instead, Matthew and Jamie were meant to meet him and some mates at a place called Malden Weir. But they never got there. So the kid lied to the police at the beginning of the investigation.
Yeah, oh dear.
But then fessed up that swimming was never on the agenda that day.
But they went in their swimming gear.
Yeah. Bye, Mom. Going swimming. They didn't want to raise suspicion.
But if they were going to do something else, they'd look pretty silly.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't know. Maybe they had the swimming gear in the bags. I don't know.
Right.
But also too, you know, if you put a pair of billabongs on and some flip-flops and a t-shirt.
That's an outfit.
It's any kid in the summer in Australia. Look, there are so many things that don't add up with those boys ending up at the bottom of that pylon manhole shaft. But there are also gaps in the story. Now, apparently the sergeant at Picton Police also couldn't understand how they fell down together. And on the surface, there were things dividing the police at the time, because there were a few other things that were odd. So after the boys gained access to the bridge interior through the vandalized entrance of the southbound section of the bridge, it seems like they found newspaper and lit the newspaper to make torches so they could see in the dark. And they walked apparently 300 meters along the interior of the bridge until, with the light of these newspaper torches, until they activated the fluoro lighting at the far end of the bridge, which was on. This light was on mm-hmm. when the bodies were found.
Oh.
The police also found cigarette butts, which they think belonged to the boys. So even without a cover, the lights were on. They weren't with the torches. They weren't with these lit newspapers. You'd think they'd see that fucking hole.
I'm a bit confused about this.
So where the manhole is a section of the bridge that has fluorescent lighting that's activated, sensor activated. But where they got in and then walked 300 meters to get to that pylon, they walked that in the dark and they used lit pieces of newspaper to light the way while they were walking. The bridge is completely dark because it's under the road. You're in the inside of the bridge. You're in the bridge interior. So there's no daylight there.
Oh, I see.
Also another reason why, if you're going to dry out weed,
fantastic
place. You know, it's warm, it's dry. You're not going to be found or seen, and it's dark.
Right.
The lights were on and you would think the boys would see that big fucking hole. And a senior homicide detective initially suggested the boys had fallen into the shaft trying to lift that manhole cover.
Yeah.
But
where's the manhole cover?
Exactly. It's never been found. And the roads inspector actually said publicly he did not believe that it was an accident and that he thought the details were enough to raise suspicion.
Well, he saw the bodies, didn't he?
Yes. He found – well, he smelt the smell.
He smelt the smell, right.
If I was him, I wouldn't go looking for that source of that smell.
No.
But he thought a third person might have been with the boys and that he found it all suspicious.
Okay.
And another theory is that the boys might have been playing sword fights with bits of electrical conduit.
Oh, God.
Because maybe not realizing that the manhole was uncovered, they like play sword fighting and fell in accidentally. With maybe one boy falling in and then grabbing at the other boy and dragging him into the shaft with him. They think this because there were bits of plastic electrical conduit found on top of the bodies of the boys. And I will say that because of the state of the bodies when they were found, it could not be determined whether the boys survived the fall or if they died on impact. Because like I said, hot summer. They were not found for more than 2 weeks. And I'll let you fill in the gaps there about the state of them.
Okay.
I did read that forensic entomology of the insect larvae on the bodies.
Which you're all up into now, Michelle, after doing the body farms.
Oh, yes, it's all about the insect larvae. Well,
microbiomes. What were they called again? I can't remember.
Foul things. Well, the insect larvae did indicate that the boys died on the same day they entered the bridge when they have done their forensic timelines on that. And like you said, Ivan Milat, he was thrown into the mix as maybe a theory of what happened to those boys. I mean, it's not out of the realms of possibility that he could have been involved, especially as there had been rumors at that time that local kids had been shot at.
Oh.
But there was never any proper evidence to support those claims. And like I said, you know, Ivan Milat's MO was basically to abduct, rob, torture and murder. It kind of doesn't fit, but maybe it was all part of his murder spree. Another strange thing about this case is that earlier media reports said that Jamie, who had fallen down into the well, into the shaft, he wasn't wearing a t-shirt. Apparently, the t-shirt was found neatly folded near the shaft.
Oh, God.
Forensic investigator Esther McKay has written about this case in her book Crime Scene, and she said she believes the shirt lay as it fell and wasn't neatly folded as reported.
Right. So that may have been hearsay.
Yes, but why would you make up a detail like that? Was it moved before Esther saw it? And why wasn't Jamie wearing a shirt?
Who would suddenly fold it, though, if you weren't part of the investigating team? You wouldn't do that.
Well, I also did read that Esther McKay did write in her book, one of the main problems of this whole case included contamination of the crime scene by the police themselves and the media who swarmed the site back then.
Right.
Not much was known about how to preserve a crime scene. And for small town police who'd never had to do anything like this before, I think they were a bit out of their depth. So I imagine a lot of evidence that might have been applicable was lost at the entry site that the boys used to gain access to the bridge, not just by the police, but by public standing around. They were smoking cigarettes. You know, apparently the press arrived with eskies full of beers.
Oh my God.
It was
God.
A bit of a free-for-all. So apparently Esther McKay had to scream at them all to leave, but the evidence was already tainted and not usable. Fuck. So there wasn't even crime tape put up to keep
That's
people
insane.
Out of the area. When I think about the T-shirt in the context of this, maybe it was folded up by a member of the public, by the boys, by the possible murderer, or maybe it was just folded or thrown or whatever by whoever.
Yeah, yeah.
You just don't know. This is really gut-wrenching.
Oh, dear.
Apparently, fingernail scratches were found near the top of the opening of the manhole. Oh. So to me, because I don't know if it was inside the manhole or at the edge of the manhole, but that indicates in a way that they were maybe made trying to prevent one of them falling in, or maybe they'd already fallen in but had caught the top or and then fell to yeah. their death. But either way, it's not good. And I will also say that, talking about the cigarette butts again, Esther McKay said that cigarette butts were discovered inside the pylon, down with the bodies. Technology was not advanced enough during that time to test the DNA.
Yeah, but they saved them.
I don't know if they did. I hope they did, because they could reopen this if they've still got them. But if you look at it logically, those cigarette butts were either from the boys smoking and throwing them in, or they had cigarettes on them, were alive when they fell in and were smoking while they were still alive at the bottom, or they were pushed and someone threw some cigarette butts in afterwards.
God. It's just, it paints such a dark picture, doesn't it? I'm so unsettled by this story, Michelle.
It's awful. But circling back to Esther McKay's book, as mentioned, she was the forensic investigator. And this is a quote from her. She says, "It was my view that the boys had voluntarily climbed into the bridge.
Oh.
In darkness, they had lit the newspaper and used it to make a paper torch as they walked through the tunnel to the master switch where they operated the internal lights. They then walked back along the tunnel, stopping at the southeastern pylon where they sat around the open manhole and smoked cigarettes. The boys then pulled pieces of conduit from the nearby electrical channel and played with them, possibly using them as swords, poking them at each other until one of the boys accidentally overbalanced and fell into the hole, grabbing the second boy by the waist of his shorts, causing a rip down the front.
Right.
The second boy was pulled down by the weight of the first and tried to grab the sides of the manhole, hence the five-fingered death grip and black scarf marks from the soles of his running shoes. I believe that both boys fell to their deaths with the pieces of conduit, one of them hitting the exposed steel rods on the way down."
Yikes.
Oh my God. "They were both killed on impact."
Okay.
Honestly, I find that very chilling, but also a very logical interpretation of what might have happened that day. But if you scour the internet, Geordie, you will find comments from people who knew the boys, and some of them are really interesting. One reads, "I went to Picton High with these two lads. We were in the same metalwork and art class. I remembering this happening, and there were some rumours of an older guy being involved."
Oh.
"Such a tragedy. R.I.P. Matt and Jamie."
Oh, God.
"Could there be some kind of grooming going on? Were they going there to buy weed and the deal went wrong?"
Mm.
I don't know.
It's an awful lot of weed to buy for those two young chaps, though, because it sounds like it was a lot of money's worth, the way that you described it.
Yes.
It wasn't a bag. It wasn't a baggie.
It wasn't a baggie of weed. And remember I told you about the woman from Reddit who said about her brother being one of the guys?
Yeah.
She says, my brother Lance Rice was one of the two rescue squad who had abseiling experience. He nearly died due to his oxygen tank faltering.
What?
My family watched the complete recovery on video, taped from a tape. Details were not clear, thank God.
Oh, thank God.
It was pretty horrific.
Yeah. He needed oxygen to get down there.
Yeah. 33 meters down. You're not getting a lot of oxygen, I guess, down there. And you don't know how long you're going to be down there with the recovery. And finally, Geordie, this is a quote from Philip Hendricks, the kid who was the friend.
Yeah.
And this is a quote from him as an adult looking back at the case. And he says, I've read Esther McKay's book and I gave evidence at the courthouse and I still can't believe it was misadventure, because even though Jamie and Matt were young, they weren't dumb. Someone out there knows what happened to them that day and they won't tell.
Someone knows something.
Eavesdropping.
Oh, God.
So what do you think?
Well, Esther McKay is probably the closest thing to what I think, because mm-hmm. there's no other evidence elsewhere. The only thing is, where was that bloody manhole cover?
Where was the manhole cover? Why was it gone? Why was there weed found in the bridge?
Yeah.
Did this boy see something they shouldn't have? Whose cigarette butts were they? You know, I think there's a lot that is of its time. You know, the forensics weren't great. I mean, poor old Esther McKay, I'm sure she'd feel not very nice me saying that, because she's a forensic investigator. But, you know, the DNA.
Well, she did what she could. She did what she could. And
it was a very logical explanation that she came up with.
And the crime scene was contaminated to shit by all these people.
Yeah.
Netflix, get in touch. You can have this one on us. Turn it into a deep dive docudrama or something. And then maybe we might get closer to finding out the truth.
Because like you said, someone knows something. There is someone out there who knows a little bit more about this case, who's kept stum for all these years. And who knows, maybe new evidence will come out, because there has been some interest in this case in the last few years.
Really?
But there's not a lot online about it. Not a lot at all.
Well, done for the deep digging that you've done there, Michelle. It's nothing. You're nothing if not, what's the word I'm looking for?
Thorough.
If it's out there, she'll find it, people. She's the one to go to for the deep digging.
Well, I have to thank Shari, eavesdropper Shari, who brought this to our attention. So thanks, Shari. I hope that you and Yasmin have a listen and you maybe learn a few things that you didn't know before.
Yeah, intriguing.
I'm just about hoarse now, so I think it's time to wrap this up.
Right, well then, in that case, look forward next week, dear eavesdroppers, to another deep dive. And until then, it's, what do we say?
There's only one thing left to say. Three things left to say.
And that is,
wherever you are,
whatever you do,
just
keep eavesdropping.
Eavesdroppin'. I didn't say eavesdroppin'.
Eavesdroppin'. Eavesdroppin'. Eavesdroppin'. Eavesdroppin'. Eavesdroppin'. Eavesdroppin'.